Hello, I'm Brian.
I'm Caroline.
This is the Computer Weekly.
Downtime Upload.
Podcast.
That third voice was Joe Halloran, our networking editor. Welcome to the podcast, Joe.
Thank you, Brian.
First time on this particular podcast. Standing in for Claire, as well as representing himself. Claire can't be with us just now. We're recording this on Friday the 15th of May, which is 2 days after the relaxation of the lockdown in England. Not Scotland, not Wales, not Northern Ireland, but England. So, got a new person on the podcast, and it's the first weekend, therefore, coming up after the slight relaxation of the lockdown, shall we say. Joe, let's start with you. What are you anticipating down on the south coast?
Oh, almost literally. I'm 50 yards from the beach. I'm anticipating the hordes of kiteboarders will return. So if anyone's not familiar with what that is, it's essentially people on a surfboard propelled along propelled by the very strong winds on the coast, basically all along east and, unfortunately, sometimes out to France. And given that the Coast Guards are still working, thankfully, but there's no lifeguards to come fish them out as yet. But as I say, there's my usual Saturday I jog down the coast, probably curtailed, obviously for keeping one's 2 metres social distance.
So maybe a new flood of tourists.
If that is the collective noun.
Yes. I'm in a similar kind of tourist attracting place in Oxford, so I'm anticipating that there will be more people in the parks. I don't know why they want to come to Oxford when everything's closed and the colleges are all closed, the museums are closed. But yeah, there's a very nice sort of set of university parks, which is a nice big green space. So I'm sure that will be fuller this weekend than in previous weekends. It's also it's my brother-in-law's birthday today. He's a golfer in Glasgow, so he's not getting to golf. Yeah. Whereas the golfers in England are getting to golf. I'm sure that Surrey golf courses will be heaving this weekend.
I think we're very good law-abiding citizens in Surrey, so I don't think people will be rushing out just yet.
But you're not going to be golfing. You're going to be doing something else.
So, one of the things I sort of said I was going to do during lockdown is we have like a hole in our garden, which is probably about big enough to get a foot and a thigh through, like an adult foot and thigh through. And it's been there since we moved in. And it was just one of those things, as we were walking around the property and we're getting shown around by the estate agent. They were just like, oh, here's the garden and that hole takes care of itself. Don't worry about that. It won't affect the value of the property. Do you want to buy it? Blah, blah. I'm like, okay, yeah, sure, why not? And it was only afterwards that we were like, what is that hole? And one of our neighbours said to us, oh, all these houses that we're in like terraced houses. But the cottages, as they are, all used to be owned by workers who worked in this kind of family-run sort of garden centre place. And so they used to grow all the produce for the garden centre in the row of gardens behind our house. That used to be a communal garden. That's all been hived off over the years. So each property's got its own one. But to keep all the plants topped up, they all had their own wells, like each garden. And all of our neighbours have covered their wells over. And apparently that's what the hole in our lawn is it's a well. So I just saw a bit of spare time over lockdown. I want to find out if, you know, is it safe to use? Could we use it? Because I've been sort of planting out loads of vegetables and plants and stuff. Is it safe to use? But also, what is just down there in this hole? When you think of a well, you think of like a beautiful sort of brick-built construction. So I was like, I've never seen down there. So I bought a camera off Amazon. It's called a snake camera, and it's just on a long piece of cable, and it's got a light attached to it. So I'm going to feed it down there. It plugs into your phone, so you can see in real time what it's seeing, and just see what's down in the hole, really, and whether or not we are stupid to be even considering pumping whatever fluid is down there onto like stuff we might potentially eat.
Scandi noir,
yeah,
for crime dramas to
Yeah, exactly.
One or two possibilities.
Well, that's need to be Scandi. You know about the Welsh noir, which mon noir.
Heard of that? Yeah.
Yeah, as I warned our boss Brian this morning, like if you don't hear from me on Monday morning on the daily editorial call, it's possibly because I've fallen in. Or, yeah, in line with what you're saying, I might be part of a sudden police investigation if we find anything that is percent body parts, who knows what. But yeah, it was an like I said, when we moved in, it was exposed. So I don't know, I'm a bit like, there could be anything in there really. But yeah, that'd be all the fun to find out this weekend.
And, it does sound fascinating. So, top line guys on the pod today, mostly going to focus on the government's COVID-19 track and trace app, which is being currently trialled on the Isle of Wight. Joe's been covering this very assiduously. It's built up a mammoth body of work on the topic. And Caroline's going to chip in with that topic as well. That will then lead us into a little chat towards the end about diversity and inclusion in software development, specifically in this case, software development for older people. Comes to most of us in the end, old age. Kick off with this fascinating little COVID-19 government app. Joe, I'm going to ask you a very unfair question. What is it? What is this app?
Which is a very good question in itself, because I think the whole issue exposes huge divides between the scientific and technical communities who developed the app, the scientific and technology communities who are cognizant of what the app does, and then the general public. And in this, and there's almost like a chasm into which I feel the function, the purpose, and the outcomes of the app have really, really collapsed, and which to the detriment of its uptake. So let's have a look at it. The app itself, and it's important to stress, works in tandem with the government's testing, or we'll call it a regime or framework. It's not a standalone thing in itself, in the way it tends to be reported in the mainstream press and the mainstream media.
Right.
What it does, very, very simply, it's an app that Android and Apple smartphones, or users of Apple and Android smartphones, which is kind of going to be important in a second, can download, and essentially it enables the user to upload some symptoms about themselves, how they're feeling, and they would then be advised whether, according to the app, they're presenting all of the classic symptoms of contracting COVID-19. At that point, they will be advised to seek medical help, but also at that point, they will send information to a centralized database. That won't be the last time this phrase is used. That notifies the NHS that the person has or tested positive. The function of the UK app, and again stressing the UK app, is it's anonymized in so much as you access the app, and as you register, only by inputting the first digit of your postcode. Now, I'm here in sunny Shoreham, IC. I'd put in VN43, as would anybody else in our locale. And then the government would know that someone in VN43 has a certain status as regards COVID-19. And that is all. They don't know who I am, my name, no other details for input. It's just that a person has this status. Now, subsequent to that, once people have imported their status, they then will get an alert if they are within close proximity. And obviously, we've all heard about the 2 meter proximity and keeping distance. It's going to be a bit further than that, about typically about like 5-3 meters. If you're in proximity to somebody who has tested positive, not negative, for the symptoms, and that's really what it does. It advises you that you're within, especially within 2 meters of someone with COVID-19 symptoms. If you are, it then advises you to self-isolate and then subsequently get medical advice or treatment.
And presumably there's a time on that as well. Like if you're close to someone for 15 minutes, it'll tell you, but not if you've just passed them by in the street.
In theory, yes. In practice, as the tests seem to be finding out, no. It's just you've pinged somebody who happens to be positive. Now, as the people who know more about medicine can tell you, the viral loads and exposure are very much a function and very much proportional to the relative distance. So, but there's no real timing. It'll just be when you first become within 2 meters of someone who's tested positive. You could then immediately step back, but you would be told you're within. It's your prerogative to self-isolate. And I think this comes to the issue about privacy. The government then doesn't say you have some mark, you're to do this. You're just advised to self-isolate. You're just then advised to take the necessary steps.
Why did they create it in the first place?
Well, it's part of, as I say, the tracing and tracking campaign, which has been, other similar campaigns have been used to great effect by China, but more particularly by Korea. And there's other apps in actual use in Israel as well. But the Korean one is really the exemplar of using contact tracing the tracking and tracing and testing regime, to be more precise. As in, they know where people are, what their status is. And one of the things the NHS wants to get out of this, and why the use of a centralized database, like the Koreans, is to look at clusters of infection. That's really, really important data for the NHS to use, to look at where to devote medical resources. Now, with all due respect to yourself, Brian, Scotland is a massively big country with few populations of great density outside of, say, Glasgow or Edinburgh. It's a very different case in London. You could do it suburb to suburb. It is very important for the NHS not to devote resources to, say, the middle of the Yorkshire, the wild bits of Yorkshire or mid Wales, or even the mid Scotland areas. You need the resources in the cities. And this will give the government an idea of where the clusters are, and they can act accordingly. A similar thing was happening in Singapore, and they've done a good job, but I think that's got more good publicity than I was good in terms of downloads. But I think Korea is the example of this. And if you look, the Korean app, its testing regime, has led to really, really low rates of infection, and they're getting back to normal. I think that's the end game here. Mm. As it's just all about getting the country back to normal.
Because in the case of South Korea, and I might be wrong on this, it does seem to be more like the app is kind of a supplement to a really robust, good sort of human and physical infrastructure around testing and all that kind of stuff. Whereas over here, perhaps because we don't have that, it seems to be more like the app is everything. And it seems that there's more pressure on the app, but at the same time, it's just...
That's what I'm saying at the top. This chasm of information between the users and the developers, I think a perception has arrived within the general communities of the app has some magical powers. It doesn't. Without the testing regime, like in Korea, it really is just like data. There's no real outcome. The outcome is being able to test positively. Because like any technology, it's not foolproof. Mm. And it only advises you whether you think you may have the classic symptoms. It could well be on subsequent investigation within testing that you don't, or or you may well have the symptoms, and or you may be asymptomatic. Without testing, it doesn't really mean anything.
And it's been tested on the Isle of Wight, as we know. I mean, how's that going?
Well, it's early days, and the official launch days on the Isle of Wight was the 4th of May. And I think, as much as we all love in technology media to write about things failing, it's far too early. And I actually, in fairness to the government, the app is really being given a scrutiny that commercial technology really doesn't have. Uh-huh. This is a beta test.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the expectations are far too great on what is a beta test. Only weeks ago, this thing was tested on an army or an Air Force camp in North Yorkshire. What the Isle of Wight test will do will probably show what doesn't work. And that, I believe, is just as important as what does work. There are reports anecdotally of classic teething problems.
Mm.
But this is what a beta test is meant to do. I'd be very suspicious of a beta test that didn't have teething problems, that didn't have issues about getting people to download it. This is the thing we've got to be fair here. And I don't know why, but the NHS Digital Initiative, NHSX, as it's called, they've given themselves a target to launch this month. I think that's a very, very aggressive target. I think it won't be met. But, you know, again, I can't stress this is a test. Issues have come up about a few downloads, and most importantly, power issues with phones and with the use of the centralized database. On certain phones, particularly Androids, power can drain away.
Mm.
There's also issues with iOS, but the experts have said this is not so much of an issue, but it's there. That's one of the weaknesses of a centralized database. But again, this is what the test aims to find out. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. That's, you know, it's not let loose onto the general public of like 55 million people in NHS England's patch. It's 140,000 people in the Isle of Wight.
And there is a second app in play, isn't there?
Well, yeah. So there again, there's the media, this mythical beast of the second app. Just to explain, only this week, some government documents were published showing that the London-based division of a Swiss software engineering firm are working on an application. They've started on the 6th of May, and they have a six-month contract that is worth just over £3 million to examine what essentially is a contract tracing app. Now, they've been set to work on this. Just to stress, there is no official details on what we're doing. It is almost readily assumed by everybody that this so-called second app will be using a decentralized database like a lot of the other contract tracing apps are. And I think the government itself or government ministers have gone on the record to say, whilst they're looking at the Isle of Wight test, they will reserve the right to look at alternatives if needs be, and if it's appropriate to get the best thing that is available for the NHS.
I think the quote I saw was something like, what was it? It was really, yeah, it's quite interestingly evasive when there is so much, there's a second app. It's like, oh, well, and it's like, something is under construction in the interest of taking notice of global developments. And it's like, so is there another app? See, just be upfront about it.
Which is on the record. This is on the government or NHS own website of the contractual details, which are very, very fulsome.
Yeah.
The company itself, I believe, has links to VMware, which I think is only a positive, which, you know, and it's also, as we believe, again, as not definitively, they're using APIs developed by Apple and Google, which will almost certainly come out into the mix of the contact tracing app, which will be launched in Germany, to supplement its own testing regime, which I think, as everyone knows, is very, very robust. So, yeah, but it's a grand assumption. All we can say is work on an app, or a private company has been engaged by the NHS to produce an app, and which will be released between now and November.
Mm.
But the work is being carried out.
And one of the concerns on that, isn't there, is that obviously you've got, well, every country seems to be taking their own approach to creating their own apps. But just within the UK, the fact you might have two apps, there are concerns that they won't talk to each other. So if we do end up pursuing two apps, you know, it's sort of like, well, you could have someone who is maybe walking around town with coronavirus symptoms, and then someone who might be oblivious to it because they just happen to be on the wrong app. And at the moment, it's unclear of what would happen. Like, if one app is shown to be, would they just, you know, cull one and pursue the other? It's, yeah, there's lots to work out.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, again, it's very, like, speculative, but I really do think once the Isle of Wight test, which is taking place at the same time as the second app development is taking place, my hunch is that they'll look at the Isle of Wight tests. If they're not satisfactory in terms of uptake, in terms of any technical issues, I think they'll run a second test using that second app, whatever that is, before there's a mass distribution to the UK, or certainly England in general. Now, I think what's crucial about this is to look at timings. And I think if only this morning, if the NHS has released data, reporting of online symptoms of coronavirus using its telephone and online reporting facilities. Now, there's a massive spike from early March up until almost to right where the lockdown was announced on the 23rd of March. And then if you track that, this has fallen by a factor of about a third to the present time. So the lockdown is actually working, and the traffic patterns of the network show this. The government are probably under pressure to make a general call before the next peak, which will arrive in the next flu season, which I was talking to my contacts within the NHS. They're expecting around November time. So I think that kind of like ties in with the contractual arrangement with the Swiss company.
Okay.
So a second, I think, an app of whatever form, as you say, there'll be one. I don't think they'll take a call one way or the other. I think it's a great point about mistakes. There will be an app for everyone. And again, I don't think this company would be engaged to just not do anything.
Yeah.
I think there may be a second trial. Now, the Isle of Wight has got a lot of advances. It's a self-contained island, and and it's got very nice geolocking, so nobody else can download it anywhere else. I'd be struggling to see where the next test bed is, but I think we're in for a second test sometime soon, maybe mid-summer, so that a rollout before November, so that next peak arrives.
It is a very ambitious target to have it out sort of by next month, based on, like you say, just a relatively small sample, if self-contained sample, on the Isle of Wight. And you just kind of, and this probably will actually go on to something Brian's going to talk about later with the feature he's talking about. But it's an app that's got to, you know, accommodate potentially the entire country. So usability has got to be just so finessed, just so that it is intuitive to use for everybody. Everyone knows what they're doing, and you know, there's no risk of user error as well in how it's used. It's a mammoth task, and like you say, it's got to be done properly. And you know, I know we are in a race to get lockdown eased and get people back to normal or back to, you know, an adjusted new normal. But yeah, this just doesn't seem like something that should be rushed.
No, it is definitely a battle against time. Again, from what I've seen of the interface of the app, it is simple to use. Oh. And it looks, you know, to me very, very familiar to a form you'd fill in the hospital with the same typeface, clear font. I, you know, I think it's very, very simple. There's no like fancy graphics to it. So, which I think like completely necessary. But what comes down to the issue is, you know, we're probably all well familiar with smartphones.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people in the general population who aren't, who don't own a smartphone. What happens to them? You know, and there is
presumably there is a physical kind of contact tracing program. I mean, our colleague Aaron Tan in Singapore was saying that, yeah, they've got an app over there. He didn't seem that keen on it because it was draining his battery. But he also said that the army and the police in Singapore, they've got a big contact tracing effort going on. And I believe also in San Francisco, you've got kind of boots on the ground doing contact tracing, so it's not the only thing that's going to be used to track the disease.
Again, coming back to Germany, I think it's very, very understated the physical human resources the German medical infrastructure has, just in terms of people doing tracing. It's not about the technology. Without or doing the actual, as you say, boots on the ground, it's all very much part of an apparatus. The other interesting thing, though, is about being representative. Is it worth it? Now, Matthew Gould, who's the chief executive of NHSX,
yeah,
told Parliament a few weeks ago that to be definitive, it needed to be around 60% of the population to download. You know, again, Caroline, we're talking about aggressive timeframes. Well, there's an aggressive target,
yeah,
of 60%. Now, subsequently, Matthew Gould has said, even if they don't get anywhere near that, and the Singapore app, for all that was highly publicised and it's a very, very techy, very, you know, much younger society, that was getting 20% uptake. Mm. Now, NHS have said they'd be happy with 20%, that because it would give them some data to use. In an ideal world, it'd be 50, 60. Other experts I've spoken to have said exactly the same. But I think there's an expectation here about, and again, this is the trial. This is what we'll find out. Why didn't people take the thing up? That's the type of data, in fairness, it is a test.
But presumably that 20% being valuable will be a function of being based on a centralized model.
Yes, that's what the whole point of the centralised model is.
Right. NHS. It's quite controversial, isn't it, among privacy campaigners? And
if asked a personal opinion on this, I'm with the NHS scientists. For them, having the data allows them, and they've told me, and I was on a conference call with them, they've got big data and analytics engines from which they will use the data and produce what they believe will be meaningful outcomes for the NHS, which I guess in plain English means they can do something with the location patterns that emerge, even if it's like low in the 20s. I think this is a big cultural call we have to make here. What's more important, given the NHS access and information to a degree of where we are or where somebody is, even if it was randomly generated IDs that are really anonymous, what's most important, the privacy of that or the usability or the efficacy of the system for the NHS? Personally, I think give the scientists and the modelers more data. A lot of people would disagree. And I think that's just like the great thing about we live in a free, open democracy. It's a genuine matter of debate.
Because we are seeing it vary by country by country, but also a bit like in the UK, some countries may have started off with a centralised model and have actually we're switching now to the Apple Google kind of decentralized model instead. And they're just, yeah, there's lots of, well, it's just diverging all over the place. And yeah, so it seems to be that they're in the decentralized case, it's countries that, you know, they don't want perhaps governments or health authorities having, you know, free rein over the data that's being shared. And like I say, you kind of respect, you know, the reasons for doing it, but yeah, like you say, Joe, in this is a global emergency, doesn't it make sense to have as access to as much data as possible, have as much data as possible being shared? It's, yeah, it's a real, real difficult one to sort of work out what's the best way forward, really.
I think you make a great point there about that Europe and how different countries have done different approach. And if I'd advise anyone to look at the Pan-European Privacy Preserving Proximity Tracing Protocol, that's PEP.
It's a lot of P's.
You must give the link for that so we can put it in the...
Oh, absolutely. And which was a lot of work went into it, and it looks like it's just been abandoned by the German government to take up APIs developed by Apple and Google, just so they can get the app out the door quicker. So, again, this, you're absolutely right. And there's, you think if there was one thing the global IT or and also governments could agree on, is a unified approach, but sadly not.
Mm. It could be a really big missed opportunity in a way, because one of the things about this pandemic is it affects everyone.
But yeah, it is interesting that when every country is facing the same goal, everyone is taking their own approach to it. You know, you kind of think, would this be a case of we could get where we need to be faster if everybody works together, trying to just create one single app? But then I don't know if that is just like a happy clappy utopia that's just never going to be possible for those reasons.
I think that's a great point about where we need to be, wherever the we is and where do we need to be. And if you look at, say, for example, Israel, and there's suggestions that the Israeli government is using the contact tracing app they have, which is quite effective, for surveillance purposes in certain communities. Only, you know, and I mean, just before we began this podcast, there were suggestions that the UK government app, well, the data generated might be fed into like general NHS databases, which is this danger of mission creep. That can't be shied away from. It's there, it's present, you know. So, but yeah, no, that's a great point about like, where do we need to be? That's really a question.
And at the minute, you can only download the app if you're on the Isle of Wight.
Indeed, yes.
So we can't check it out for ourselves.
I have tried that just to see if you can break the model. I'm an old engineer. First thing you do is try and break something. In fact, I used to break things for a living. But the good news is, it's only downloadable on the Isle of Wight.
Yeah, I was just using Google Maps to see how close Shoreham is to the Isle of Wight. Because as actually a frequent holidayer to the Isle of Wight, you can usually pick up like French phone signals and dodgy TV stations from overseas. I was just wondering, maybe if we put Joe out on one of the paddle boards or whatever he was complaining about at the top of the call, that might be your way in. So,
well, that is, you know, it's not too far away. And if I just walk 3 miles up to the beautiful South Downs, which are now open to everybody again, you can actually see the Isle of Wight on a clear day.
Well, there we go. Maybe that's our. Might be a bit extreme, but it'd be our way of testing, kicking the tires. And...
One of the things that's said about the app is old people, they don't have smartphones, so how's it going to work for them?
Well, quite. I was trying to be sensitive and mention that, but a stereotype in itself. You know, I'd say fewer people over the age of 50 have smartphones compared with those under the age of 40. Let's leave it like that. But yeah, but you're right. It's not representative of the population as a whole. And also, if you look at the Isle of Wight, like a lot of coastal places not too far away from where I am, there are a lot of old people. It's perhaps like atypical to say like central London, where like general smartphone usage would be a lot higher.
Yeah.
I think that, but again, to be like fair to the model, you know, and as mathematicians are one to say, without loss of generality, you have to like bear that in mind.
And a mathematician is what you are, Joe.
Oh, yes. It floods out. It's all about numbers and modelling. Interesting to see. And it's interesting to see people in the Financial Times who did their data modelling and now interviewed on the BBC for their prowess. I don't think that's ever happened before, and I doubt it will happen again. It's the time for the number people, Brian.
And Caroline's a medical biochemist by background, so I'm the humanities kind of fluffy person in the middle here. But that discussion, Joe, brings me very neatly onto a feature that we've published, I commissioned, on the very topic of designing software for older people. A piece by Stephen Matheson, a very nice feature, which I wanted to give a bit of publicity to. I commissioned this from Stephen. He wrote it, he pitched it, it was his idea. I did write the headline, though. That was
credit where it's due.
I'll take that credit. Designing software to include older people in the digital world, especially pertinent to this time of lockdown and social isolation, which is highly mitigated for us by the fact that we can go online in a way which a lot of people aren't. There's a couple of stats in Stephen's feature, which I thought were really arresting. So one quarter of people aged 65 and above in the UK are not on the internet. One quarter. Mm. And when you look at women in particular, women in their 70s, only 41% of them have touched the internet in recent months. We do kind of forget sometimes that there is that kind of big exclusion zone among people in that sort of generation. Stephen's piece has got some practical tips for inclusion. I won't go through all of those tips. One's to do with sight, the kind of failing sight of older people. Mm. Recommendation to use high contrast, kind of commonsensical principles, really. Also, I didn't know that hearing is a sense that begins to diminish from about the age of 30.
Yeah, I read that and I started getting really panicky. I started like sort of me using tuning forks. Like, can I hear? Oh, I don't know if I can even hear that. Like, yeah, a few alarm bells. And I could hear those when I read it.
Small changes and make them often is one of the things that one of his sources says. Another one of his sources said that voice is actually, I thought this was interesting, voice is a good interface for older people. Which goes with the whole kind of, you know, recent wave of technological development around voice. I mean, Alexa is my companion in isolation. So there you go. But another point in the feature, though, that I thought was interesting was if you go down the route of specially designing for older people, that's not good. So one of his sources talked about being involved in a project to have a mobile phone with big buttons on it.
Now, it's funny you should mention this because quite a few jobs ago, I was an analyst. And Caroline's probably far too young to remember the Nokia 3410.
I do, yeah, I think that was my sister's first mobile phone. So, yeah, I do remember that.
Remember how small that was?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's where like phone developments probably hit a usability dead end. For the very reason of things were getting smaller and smaller and smaller, until research started to come out about we might want older people to use phones. And in addition to losing one's hearing, even with or without a tuning fork to test, people just really were pressing the wrong buttons. And ironically, given what we've been speaking about in the smartphones and the Isle of Wight, the smartphones that were developed subsequently by Nokia, and especially touchscreen ones like the iPhone, were meant to address the problem of getting the older user that there was something they could use. The buttons were big. You didn't really have to look at or press the wrong button. And if you are like less dexterous of an age, And so it's a massive thing that's been on the agenda for nearly 20 years. It's just really funny that we're still talking about this. And if you think about all the advances that have been made in software development, graphical user interfaces, in the devices themselves, it's still on the agenda.
Mm. And I remember actually, I went to the launch of a phone, one of the phones, it's like, oh, this is for older people. It's got big buttons, you know, so they can see. And it also just came across as so patronizing, like, oh, you're old, you need big button, you can't see very well. We've got an extra loud ringer on it. Can you hear that, dear? Very few people want to be perceived as old, if you know what I mean. And that seemed to
absolutely
feed into that, like, oh, you've got an old person phone. Yeah. Oh, okay. No, I'm not happy with that. Yeah, so I think that is something you know, they want to be using the same technology as everybody else. You don't want it to be like something that marks you out as like less than or different to or anything.
Yeah, it's interesting, this the whole generations and technology thing. If Steve Jobs were alive, if he hadn't died, he'd be 65 this year. Hmm. Bill Gates will be 65 this year. I think you kind of forget that we all get old.
Mm.
These are the people who've invented half this technology, and it's, yeah.
But on that point, actually, I will say the whole thing around the pandemic, it has, I think, highlighted a lot of the probably issues that are talked about in that feature. As I was reading through it, it's like, for instance, in my house, we have like a Zoom call every Saturday night, and that'll be with my siblings, my parents, and sometimes some of our older relatives as well. And it is just, it's a piece of software that obviously has not been designed to be multi-generational, like, you know, in terms of usage. And you do see that really coming to the fore in terms of like, oh, how does this work? How does that work? And, you know, depending on the profile of who's on the call, like, for instance, I use Zoom in an office job, so I'm familiar with it, but then
yeah,
it's not intuitive to use for an older person. Like, not just Zoom, but a lot of the video conferencing technologies. Or not. And it's, yeah, I think when everyone's being told to, oh, you know, keep in touch with tech because you've got to self-isolate, you can't be with each other, I do think there might be more attention paid to stuff like this, like, how is stuff built? Is it built with as many people in mind, you know, that they will end up using it?
Yeah, and you think that would have been done by now.
Yeah, but then there hasn't really been a need, has it? Like, who would have predicted that when Zoom was created that, oh, a few weeks' time or a few months' time, the user base for this is going to be no longer office workers. It's going to be everybody. It's hard, but it does feed into something we talk about quite a lot on the podcast, about the importance of having diverse teams and having, you know, yeah, as many people with viewpoints as part of the development as possible.
I'm just going to bring in someone from Generation X.
I'm a baby boomer. I was born in 1964. Thank you very much. On the old stuff. But yeah, no, again, you're making great points here. And if far be it for me to big up the research that our own company commissioned at the end of last year and from the beginning of this year about communications and why, you know, Caroline mentions that they're not built for everyone. Well, there's an industry that up until the beginning, I'd say January this year, one of the pertinent questions was, would there actually be a unified communications industry per se? It was seen by many, and words like we use, like death throes and secular decline. Because, you know, both companies looked at this, these things like Zoom existed and Slack, Teams were always there.
Mm.
There's been very, very scant development in it, because who needed them? More the necessity for them. They weren't consumers. It was, you know, I'll log into the odd conference from an airport or a train station before somewhere with solid Wi-Fi before I get on a journey. The lack of usability for everybody. The development just hasn't taken place because no one thought they were important. It's very interesting to see how many just explosive use of Zoom.
Mm.
From one thing we did track. In November to April, it's almost like three times growth. It's just amazing, and you think it's all quite obvious, but it's taking something like this, it's so disruptive on so many levels, and feeding into the horrible phrase, the new norm, these things become very, very sticky, and we're all going to get used to doing conferencing. But we've seen already the likes of Verizon buy Blue Jeans Networks. That's, you know, it's very, very corporate play. But the next thing is make the things a lot more usable, given the things are going to get a lot more used by everybody. And that starts with the interface. Make it less intimidating about sessions the whole way. I think we all know there's like colleagues of ours, much younger than baby boomers like I, who don't know where the mute button is or accidentally take themselves out of sessions. And, you know, I don't think it's unfair to say usability wasn't top of mind. But here's another thing about, like, when you say using Zoom, a lot of people won't be going to the doctors or will be using conferencing to talk to the doctors. Thankfully, the UK's networks have been proven to be robust. That's the good news. So let's now start looking at the tools the networks are going to support. It's tools like this. They have to be better. They have to, and again, to be more inclusive for those who aren't technological whisk kids and whisk girls. Diversity has to be an issue in the next iterations of design and in general.
I think that's really well put, John. It's a really nice feature by Stephen. We'll include a link to it. Well, look, who knows, by the time of the next pandemic, and there will be another.
This won't be right, long. Thanks. Let's get through this one first.
We'll all be zooming away in our care homes. Sadly, that's all we've got time for this week. On this occasion, it just remains for me to say thank you very much to our guest, Joe.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
And thank you very much, as ever, to Caroline.
You're welcome.
And thank you very much to you, listener, for listening. Okay, stay safe and take care. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.